is Block by Block, a community news program from WPPM LP 106.5 FM, where we explore issues affecting the Philadelphia area with news reports from the members of our community. I'm Julia Lowe.
And I'm Natalie Thomas. In the next half hour, we'll hear stories from our community news reporters about how immigrant advocacy groups in our region are preparing for the incoming Trump administration, a jazz festival scheduled to take place in Germantown next year, and the negative side of social media.
But first, last month, SEPTA announced it would have to cut regional rail service and increase fares by more than 20% due to a budget shortfall. Governor Josh Shapiro averted the crisis by announcing that he would take $153 million in federal highway funds and give them to SEPTA. But as Block by Block's Lisa Barnes reports, that's only a temporary fix.
Shapiro's assistance averted a crisis for SEPTA, but the support will only solve SEPTA's financial problems until July 1st of 2025, when SEPTA's new fiscal year begins. This is not the first time SEPTA has found itself in debt and had to be bailed out. I asked Connor Deschmecker of the transit advocacy group Transit Forward, why does this keep happening?
SEPTA is and has been critically underfunded for decades. Compared to even other agencies of our size, we receive a very low amount of funding. In 2005, we were in this exact same situation where there was a structural deficit. Governor Rendell flexed federal highway dollars and got us out of a crisis for a short period of time. In 2010, the same thing happened. He flexed a little bit of money and threatened to flex a whole lot more. And then finally in 2012-13, the legislature passed Act 89, which provided a dedicated line item that did not have to be haggled over year for public transportation. That only lasted us 10 years, though. And there have been some stopgap measures in the intervening few years, among them being American Rescue Plan dollars, which is what has kept all of our public institutions afloat over the last 4 or 5 years since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Connor says that since the last funding bill that SEPTA received in the early 2010s, SEPTA has received no additional funding from the state for its operations. This, along with changing ridership patterns due to the pandemic, has been crippling for the transportation system.
Even if everybody who went into the office 5 days a week now only goes into the office 4 days a week, that's 15% of ridership. So considering that now we're up to above 80% ridership recovery, that's a really crucial place. And so we need to be able to change the system in order to be able to meet riders where they are now, which is increased ridership in the middle of the day, increased ridership on nights and weekends, but we have lower operating revenue because there are fewer passengers.
Another issue that has added to the financially burdened transportation system's woes is the economy.
The cost of everything has gone up in the last 10 plus years. And if we have received no new money, how exactly do you pay your bills?
And yet another issue, says Connor, is a decrease in funding from the federal government.
Dating back to the Nixon administration, the traditional split was 80% of federal infrastructure dollars would go to highways and 20% would go to public transportation. In the two major pieces of infrastructure legislation that were passed under the Biden administration, that proportion worsened for public transportation. And now 82% of federal infrastructure dollars are going to highways and 18% are going for transit. So we're at the squeeze from the federal level. We have lower ridership. We have stagnated support from the state government. And if we wanted to raise more money at the local government level, whether that be from Philadelphia on its own, whether it's from the collar counties, whether it's from sort of joint regional thing, we are preempted from doing that by the state government. We're forbidden from doing a lot of things. And one of them is providing dedicated taxes and fees to transportation infrastructure, not just public transit, but any kind of transportation infrastructure.
I asked Connor why the state government was so resistant to creating permanent funding for the transit system, and he said misperceptions about transportation are fueling these problems.
There is this misperception that transit is purely an urban issue, that transit is something that only serves Philadelphia and to a lesser extent, Pittsburgh. Obviously, there's racial and class connotations to that as well. But really, public transportation is in all 67 counties in the Commonwealth. It doesn't look the same everywhere. It's subway, trolley, train, bus in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. But there are fixed route buses in Harrisburg, Erie, Lancaster, Scranton, Allentown. The third largest public transportation system in the Commonwealth is in State College, where Penn State is. We think about something like the Incline in Johnstown, which is an important part of their economy because it's faster and easier to get up and down the steep mountainside where the Incline runs. And it's an important part of their tourist ecosystem. We also think about the fact that Amtrak runs across Pennsylvania. This is something that is in every single county, even in the most rural county. There's shared ride service, which provides elders and folks with disabilities the ability to get to their essential medical appointments, senior centers, and other things like grocery stores.
So as citizens, what can we do to help save SEPTA and save services and keep fares at a minimum?
The way that you get involved is to talk to your city council member, talk to your state legislature, and join us in movement. What's really cool about Transit Board Philadelphia is that we're a coalition. We are 35 community-based organizations across lines of difference that all recognize that public transportation is a foundational part of our region. That includes disability and elder rights groups, neighborhood associations and CDCs, immigrant refugee support organizations, interfaith groups, all the way to groups like Reclaim and Philly DSA and those kinds of grassroots political groups. So joining your local groups and talking about public transportation as a public good that we need to preserve and invest in. And so transitforallpa.org, you can join our movement. Right now, what we have up is a thank you letter to Governor Shapiro that says, you did the right thing. You bought us 6 more months, but you need to take leadership and ensure that this is not left on the bargaining room floor come the late spring and early summer when we negotiate the next budget. And it's only by working in solidarity that we can achieve these things. We sent almost 7,000 contacts to Governor Shapiro in under 2 weeks since we started talking about Flex, and he acted. So that shows the power of collective action.
The first annual Germantown Jazz Festival is scheduled to take place in the spring from April 25th through the 27th. Block by Block reporter Sherry Pennington has been volunteering to help make the festival happen. And she spoke with the person who's the driving force behind the Germantown Jazz Festival to find out more.
There's a lot of excitement going on in the Germantown community. An inaugural 3-day Germantown Jazz Festival is being planned for the spring of 2025. This event is the brainchild of jazz songstress Khadija Renee. I recently met her at a coffee shop in Germantown, and we discussed the festival. I asked why did she want the event to take place in Germantown, and what was her inspiration?
In the summer of 2023, I put on Germantown Jazz at the Nile series. It was a summer series held once a month at the Nile Cafe, the longest running African-American owned vegan restaurant in the city. It was just a real good feel, real good fit. There was not much live jazz going on in Germantown, with the exception of a few spots. So I just wanted to add to the richness of the love of music to Germantown. So Germantown, I have a love for it. It has a mix of history and culture. A lot of conscious people live in Germantown, a lot of diverse community. So that was the inspiration.
I asked Khadija, what sets this event apart from others in the city and what attendees can look forward to?
This is different from anything that's ever happened in Germantown because this is a 3-day festival. And it also encompasses various different locations throughout Germantown. We have up to 6 different venues that we're going to be having jazz concerts in a 3-day period. We're going to open up in the historic Germantown Friends School that was established in the 18th century. Senator Art Hayward is our jazz ambassador. He will be speaking We're going to be inviting the mayor, Councilwoman Cindy Bass. And then we're going to have our opening concerts featuring some of the youthful jazz ensembles. And then we're going to open up with some local acts from Philadelphia and a national headliner as well. So it's going to be a grand opening there.
That's a big event coming up for 3 days. And I know that you guys have a high budget target. I think I read somewhere about $300,000. How is that going to be accomplished?
Well, we're working on it. We're applying for grants. We have the ear of the Pennsylvania Council of Arts. They're very excited about the festival and they definitely want to fund it. So we're waiting for a word from them. The state has various different creative grants that we've applied for. We hope that we are going to get some city funds. We've also launched our own grassroots community campaign to raise funds. The monies that we raise are going to be used to pay the venues and the musicians, not going in anybody's pocket. So we do have some mini concerts. So we're having a fundraising event called the Germantown Jazz Festival Presents, a jazz night out. We're holding that on the 27th of December, which is during the week of Kwanzaa at the Braid Mill. Of course, we're going to have live jazz, the local Germantown jazz artists performing, Julian Hartwell, Jacob Kellerby is going to be performing, Leon Jordan Jr., his quintet is going to be performing. It's going to be food, dancing, fun, live jazz. It's going to bring the community together because I'm already experiencing politicians, churches, schools, the business community, everybody's buzzing about it.
When the festival begins next year, how do you envision the agenda?
We're planning on having our headline concert in the First Presbyterian Church that evening. So if people don't want to hang out during the day, they can plan to come to the concert. Another great living jazz musician from Philadelphia, who is an 8-time Grammy Award-winning bassist, Philly homeboy, Christian McBride.
Looking ahead to the future, Khadijah had this to say.
2026 is the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence in this country. So the Germantown Jazz Festival is going to be right at the heart of that. Businesses are going to benefit because people are going to want to eat. They're going to want to hang out after the concert, before the concert, come in and stay at the hotels, you know. So it's a shot in the arm for the business community as well as just keeping Germantown, putting Germantown on the map for being a center for culture.
As the planning continues for what is promising to be an epic event, the committee is seeking support. Find out how you can help by visiting GermantownJazzFestival.com.
President-elect Donald Trump plans to carry out mass deportations of undocumented immigrants once he takes office in January. To find out how immigrants and advocates for immigrants' rights in our region are preparing for the incoming Trump administration, block-by-block reporter Lisa Barnes spoke with Kate Firestone, membership director of the Pennsylvania Immigration Coalition.
The Pennsylvania Immigration Coalition is a coalition of 60 member organizations across 27 counties in the state. We have direct service providers, organizations that do community organizing and advocacy, faith-based organizations, as well as legal services. We help immigrants by leading and supporting our member organizations in campaigns that advance immigrant rights at the local, state, and federal levels. And we build immigrant electoral power through nonpartisan voter registration and educating new citizens.
Now that Trump has been elected, he is promising to implement mass deportation policies. How are you preparing people?
Our focus now is urging Biden and his administration to dismantle as much of the deportation machine as possible before Trump takes office in January. It's a very short critical window that we have. This really means, you know, closing detention centers and ending the contracts with ICE, which is Immigration Custom Enforcement. So immigrants in detention can await their trials with their families and their communities. We're also focused on advocating for local governments and schools to end collaboration with ICE. We just don't want a repeat of the horrors the Trump administration committed when it inherited the deportation machine from the Obama administration. We know it won't necessarily stop their agenda, but it'll delay it and buy us the critical time that we need to protect our people.
What are you hearing from some of the other organizations that you work with?
Their community members are understandably very scared. Some have wondered if they're safe going to the grocery store. I attended a community meeting that was held by one of our member organizations, and there were a lot of local teachers there. They confirmed that their students are scared too, and that worse, their students are being made to feel unsafe, sometimes by their fellow classmates. Something that we're also hearing, though, is that the immigrant leaders in this state who are already hard at work for their communities, they're getting ready for what's to come, and they have told us that they're ready. Together, we're stronger.
The last time the Republicans were in office, they separated families and they placed people in detention centers. Can you talk about the impact that something like that has?
I mean, the impact it will have on immigrant families will be devastating, to tear mothers, fathers, children, grandparents, and whole communities apart and make them inaccessible to one another is horrific. And it will cause lasting damage and trauma that will affect current generations now, and it'll affect those to come.
Trump is talking about ending temporary protected status for people who arrived as undocumented immigrants from countries where it's not considered safe for them to return. What happens to them if they lose their status?
Very similar outcomes in terms of trauma and lasting damage. And also, death is a very real possibility. You know, for instance, Haitian leaders across the country have been fighting to put a stop to what they call death flights, or the deportations of whole families back to Haiti. 2 weeks ago, the Federal Aviation Administration prohibited U.S. airlines from flying to Haiti for 30 days after gangs shot 3 planes while landing at Port-au-Prince. So the violence is real. The impact is going to be devastating.
A recent Gallup poll showed that 55% of people who were surveyed were in favor of curbing immigration. Why do you think that is?
I think that mis and disinformation about immigrants is behind that. And I think it's purposely deployed and used to fuel hate and bigotry. So, for instance, it's a common misconception that immigrants, quote unquote, take jobs from Americans, but immigrants contribute to and drive economic growth. I mean, the jobs that they work are often hard to fill, and a lack of immigrant labor in key industries such as construction and food processing, which is vital to everybody here, it'll increase the cost of housing and food for everyone if we don't have workers who can work those jobs. It's also a very common misconception that immigrants don't pay taxes, but in actuality, undocumented immigrants in the U.S. contribute significantly to the nation's tax revenue. In 2022, it was estimated that they paid approximately $97 billion in taxes. And that's oftentimes paying into programs and benefits that they'll never get to take advantage of because of their status. And then one final misconception I want to address is the idea that immigrants are a quote unquote threat to public safety. In actuality, immigrants, including undocumented ones, have much lower crime rates than native-born Americans. A study in 2021 by the Department of Justice found that U.S.-born citizens were 10 times more likely than immigrants to be incarcerated for committing weapons-related offenses. So if you look at the numbers, it's not true.
What can immigrants do themselves to help prepare for a possible deportation? Is there anything that they can do?
Whether you are a citizen, documented or undocumented, you have rights in this country. You have the right to remain silent. And so it's important for immigrants to know their rights in the cases of things like workplace raids or if ICE comes to their neighborhoods or their homes. We're also encouraging people to make family preparedness plans. This usually involves identifying trusted adults who can care for your children in the case that you might not be able to, compiling lists of really important contact info, and having all those important documents for your children accessible and ready to go. We're encouraging folks to connect with local immigrant rights organizations in their areas. A great place to start with this would be our website, which is paimmigrant.org. It has a list of our coalition member organizations by county. We're organizing a rally and a march defending immigrant lives on December 18th. It's going to be at 2 p.m. at the Liberty Bell. And then, of course, in terms of advocacy, pick up the phone or get a group of friends together, call the White House, ask them to dismantle the deportation machine before it gets handed over in January. We need local governments to end any data sharing, any communication and physical collaboration with ICE. And in Philadelphia specifically, that means letting our mayor know that we absolutely must keep our sanctuary city policy protected at all costs.
With the mass amounts of people coming into the U.S. from South America, and this is on a daily basis. What do you see as a proper way of handling people coming into the country?
It's not just South America. We're really seeing migration from countries all across the global South. We believe we need to focus on simplifying the immigration process and making it easier for new Americans to get settled and integrate. We've all learned about Ellis Island and we've done this before. And the reality is also that we have an aging and declining population in this country. And in most cases of population decline, immigrants have stemmed the worst of that deterioration. So it would really actually, we believe, behoove us in the U.S. to make the process simpler so that people can get through, get settled, get working.
Social media has become a part of daily life for many people. And while it's proven to be a helpful tool for staying in touch and for learning new things about the world, social media can also have a negative impact on people's well-being. Block by Block reporter Kay Michelle Watson spoke with a local expert on problematic social media use to find out more about how the internet has changed social interactions.
My name's Scott Kaplan. I'm a professor of communication at the University of Delaware, where I've been a professor for about 25 years. I study technology and social relationships and well-being.
What was your journey to get into social media and how it worked and all the pitfalls?
I've been doing this since before social media was around. I initially started around 1999 and 2000 studying what at the time was called internet addiction or problematic internet use. I found it's interesting, these stories that I would be hearing about people getting so into it that they couldn't stop. They would be missing work. They would give up time with their real life relationships to sort of be in this cyberspace. And so that's how I started researching it. And what I found was this tool has a lot of positives for connecting people. But at the same time, a lot of those elements that are positives come with it, potential risks. One of the things that was really interesting to me was this idea that the kinds of people who had the most trouble controlling their use of the internet were the people who seemed to have problems with their real life social relationships, with loneliness, social anxiety. When social media started to come out in the early 2000s, the same people who were most drawn to the internet for the social reasons, for shyness, for feeling not confident in social situations, they were really drawn to social media because that in particular became a place where being social in a virtual way was something new and something that could make you popular.
One of the things that I see a lot is someone holding their phone. They're supposed to be conversing with somebody that's with them, but they can't. It's like, put down the phone. You're supposed to be talking. It's like we've lost that community in-person interaction. Like, let's go to have a bite to eat. Let me go over your house and just talk. We don't do that anymore. Now, not that I don't like things like FaceTime. I think that's great when you're away from family and it's a great tool, but the flip side can make it more distant.
The idea that we're more connected than ever, but we're also really lonely, I do agree with that. And in fact, there's a book by a researcher that I really like. Her name is Sherry Turkell, and she wrote a book called Alone Together. And I love the title because it captures exactly what you were saying. There's something missing about what I like to call sort of social presence, that nonverbal connection you have with somebody else. We don't have it on Zoom. So for example, I've been teaching for 25 years. I teach a very big class, like 350 people. When I used to walk into the room, it was so loud that I didn't know how to start the class. I would have to like scream or play music really loud or do something to get everyone's attention. So now when I go in, it's dead silent. Dead silent. Nobody is talking to anybody. They all have earbuds in and they're all on their phones looking down. And I say good morning, nobody looks up because they can't even hear me. And they spend the whole semester not talking to each other. And it's tragic because it's like, you know, for people who go to college, that's one of the places in your life where you're going to meet a lot of new people. And I'll say something to them like, you know, if you're going to miss class, get notes from a classmate. Students will say, I don't know anybody.
Do you have any experience or things that you want to share about maybe talking with parents? You have this computer in your house, you have this phone that you've given your kid a lot of times for safety reasons. Yeah, so how do you put stopgaps on it in order to guard them, not do a total gatekeep, but something where you can monitor what they're doing and what's going on?
I wish I had an easy answer, because it's fighting against something that's designed to be as addictive as possible for kids. So I would say two things. First, we need to look at our own usage. One of the things that's very common that I see is parents at restaurants using their phones instead of talking to their children, or using the devices as a way to keep children occupied so that they can eat their dinner, which I totally get. Yeah. And so a lot of times parents are using the technology as a way to help manage the kid. And that makes a lot of sense. But then it also leads to the kid associating the device with excitement, entertainment, and a need to constantly be stimulated. If somebody were to say to you as a librarian, how do I get my kid to love reading? Show them how much you love reading and do things around reading that are fun and not high pressure. And that kind of thing can be done with social media too. I always think about it like this. How come there's not as much binge drinking in Europe among young teenagers and adults? Yeah. And it's because it's legal to start drinking when you're 14. By the time you're 18, they're over it. The same way that Europeans think about alcohol, we can sort of think about social media. It has a place, but we also are going to keep it in its place so that it doesn't make our life really empty. I don't have children, but if I did, I would want to do things like no technology weekends, where we're going to put our phones away for the weekend and we're going to do puzzles. We're going to go for a hike. We're going to wash the car. And it just becomes something that it's part of the family value that technology has a place, but just like there's certain things we don't do when we're eating dinner. In my family, when I was younger, there was always like this, we don't watch TV when we're eating dinner. And some families did, but in our house, we didn't. It became kind of a family value and it wasn't an issue.
Block by Block is produced by Lisa Barnes, Marion Nicvere, Sherry Pennington, Jennifer Robnett, Sultan Smalley, K. Michelle Watson, and us,
Natalie Thomas,
and Julia Lowe. Lisa Barnes is our board operator tonight.
Brad Linder is Radio News Managing Editor for WPPM, Peter Liu is Radio Operations Manager, and Allison Durham is WPPM's Radio Program Manager.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode of Block by Block featuring more stories about issues affecting life in the Philly region. And you can find past episodes of the show on PhillyCam's SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you find your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.